Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. In a historic vote yesterday, the Senate moved to acquit President Trump. The Senate voted primarily along party lines, with Senator Mitt Romney being the sole Republican who voted to impeach the president on the charge of abuse of power. It ended a five-month process that we followed closely here on WLRN, carrying the impeachment hearings to you, our listeners. And it all began in the House of Representatives, which voted to impeach the president. Congresswoman Debbie McCarthy-Powell voted for the impeachment, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. Congresswoman, thank you so much for the time.
Hello, good afternoon.
So in all three previous impeachment trials in the U.S., the Senate voted to acquit the president each time, pretty much voting along party lines. Was President Trump's acquittal a surprise for the House?
No, I think we've been watching and following what the Senate was doing over the past few weeks. And it seemed obvious from the very beginning. We hadn't even voted on the impeachment articles, if you recall, Luis. And Senator Mitch McConnell said that he was coordinating with the White House and that they were going to dismiss the articles right away once they received it. Now, a lot happened in January. We all got more information from John Bolton, who used to be his national security advisor, alleging that it was indeed true that the president was withholding critical military aid that had already been approved, appropriated, to put pressure on the Ukrainian government for them to make an announcement that they were investigating his political opponent. So one of the articles, Abuse of Power, dealt specifically with this because the president of the United States, any president, whether Democrat or Republican, cannot use the power of his or her office to put pressure on a foreign government for their own private and political gain. This is one of the highest crimes and misdemeanors committed by any president. But no, it wasn't a surprise. We saw that they voted against having a fair trial. We did not see any witnesses come before the Senate. But what was surprising and great to see is the courage by Republican Senator Mitt Romney when he voted to impeach the president.
I want to come back to something that you said. I mean, going back all the way to the beginning of this process, so you'd heard what Senate Majority Leader McConnell was going to do. Why was it important for you and your Democratic colleagues in the House to move forward on impeachment if this end result was being foreshadowed?
So when we received the report from the Inspector General, it was a report that was an urgent and credible threat, which initiated the investigations in the House Intelligence Committee. I didn't run for office to come to Washington, D.C. to impeach this president. But when you are a member of the Judiciary Committee, understanding your responsibility to protect the Constitution from all foreign and domestic enemies, hearing hours and hours of evidence from witnesses that all corroborated the same information that came through the Inspector General's report, that this president was putting our national security in danger because he was using the White House, that office, for his own political gain and really inviting foreign interference in our elections. Now, if you remember, we had confirmation from all the national intelligence agencies here in the United States that confirmed that Russia interfered in the election in 2016 to help then candidate Donald Trump. So we are seeing a president being completely emboldened, violating not only the Constitution, but also federal law, using that office to do that. I thought it was my duty to follow the truth, to follow the facts, and knowing very well that it was going to be a divisive vote. But we could not move forward in this country laying a precedent that the House of Representatives, because of political consequences, we were not going to do the right thing. Well, for me, it was important to do the right thing.
Congresswoman, do you feel that you made the strongest case possible, or maybe you could have built a stronger case to send to the Senate?
You know, Luis, we have never dealt with this level of lawlessness by the White House, by the president, by his administration. It was very difficult to get all the evidence out because every witness that would have presented more clear evidence, they were blocked from appearing before the House Intelligence Committee and also my committee, the Judiciary Committee. So we had to file the subpoenas in court. We're actually still right now in court trying to, and the courts have sided with us on all these cases. We are still trying to wait to see if we're going to be able to question Don McGahn. So it was very difficult for us to get all the information, but the information that we did receive was very clear. And I thought that we, the House managers, did a great job of presenting this evidence in front of the Senate.
I want to know why the House chose to pursue just these on these two grounds, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. In your conversations with House Impeachment Manager Adam Schiff, were there other grounds that could have been pursued?
Yes, we did discuss the option of also including obstruction of justice. But like you said, for us to have the strongest case in front of the Senate, we didn't have all the information we needed because we could not bring in front of us former White House counsel Don McGahn. So we decided that if we were going to move forward with the articles of impeachment, we had to have the strongest evidence possible to bring to the Senate. And those were abuse of power and obstruction of Congress.
So whether anybody likes it or not, there are political ramifications. What about the upcoming election? How do you think the voters will play this out? Because, look, some people will say he'll use this to his advantage.
Yes, and we saw that this morning, and he is going to be using it in his campaign rallies. I'm certain of that. But I have faith in the American people. And I have to tell you that every time I go to my district, my community, when I talk to people in South Miami-Dade and Kendall in the Florida Keys, they see the truth. They understand what a fair trial is. They see the fact that the Senate did not bring in witnesses. They don't approve of that. And whether the Senate was going to remove the president from office or not, they have understood that what the president did was against the Constitution. It was against the law. It was not right. And I think that in 2020, which we're now in 2020, I keep saying 2020, but we're already in February of 2020. But we'll see in November the consequences of those actions.
Representative McCarsell Powell, Tuesday was the president's third State of the Union address, and he hailed the continuing drop in the unemployment rate, the passage of bipartisan trade deals, and the boom of the blue-collar economy. Is the U.S. economy in a strong position under this Congress and this president?
Well, I mean, there's no arguing that most people believe that the economy is going in the right direction. Now, in my community, Luis, I represent an area where the average salary is about $44,000 a year. We have nurses, airline workers, we have teachers that are not making enough to make ends meet in South Florida. So for them, the economy is not working for them. They're frustrated. Wages are not increasing at the rate that we need them to do so, especially in an area like South Florida where housing is expensive. Healthcare is becoming more and more expensive. So, you know, the question for me is, yes, unemployment rates may be at an all-time low. But I think it's because people are working two and three jobs to make ends meet. And the real determinant of our economy, I think at this point, should be whether wages are increasing at the rate that they should be.
You invited a 16-year-old coral researcher and scientific diver to the State of the Union address. Tell me a little bit about Marcela Munoz and the work that she's doing.
Oh, Luis, we had such a good time. Marcela represents hope to our community, especially from the Florida Keys. She's a 16-year-old student in Key West who has been diving. She's an avid scuba diver. She started diving when she was in seventh grade, and she's been really prioritizing the conservation of our coral reefs. And as you remember, I did a lot of work in Coral Restoration Foundation. I have been working to protect the Florida reefs along our coast. And she is trying to bring attention to the fact that because of the contaminants in our water, there's this bacteria that's eating the reefs in our coast. And it's a very dangerous bacteria. So she's been focusing on becoming an environmental advocate, and she is working on with doing research and actually getting the water to see the levels of contaminants every weekend. She tells me that every weekend she's doing that. Her mother came with her. She met a lot of Congress members. And I wanted to bring attention to the fact that we are not getting support from this administration on the issues that are so important to us in South Florida, and that's protecting the environment and clean water. So it was great having her here, and I think she enjoyed it as well.
I want to move from the State of the Union and back to this election, and we just had the Iowa caucuses, and by the way, they're still counting those votes. I mean, look, are you concerned about the start of this election process for the Democratic Party when you have that happening? It's going to be a fierce campaign.
It's very frustrating to see, because the last thing that we need in this country is more confusion around elections. We have been working diligently in the Judiciary Committee to make sure that we have the right hearings and conversations with the heads of election security all over the country. We just had a hearing yesterday with the FBI director, Director Ray, and my questioning was around election security. So it's frustrating to see that. Now, I have faith that in Florida, talking to the Secretary of Elections in Monroe County and in Miami-Dade County, they are ready. They have gotten the training that they need. We need to be organized. We need to be strategic. We need to make sure that every vote is counted. And so we'll see. Let's move on from Iowa and see how the rest of the primary races come out.
You're saying you're confident. I mean, we had problems in 2018 in the midterms in Broward and Palm Beach counties. You're confident?
Well, I'm confident of Miami-Dade and Monroe.
Okay.
Let me make that correction, which is exactly what I said earlier.
Okay.
Because I'm in communication with my counties. Now, it's interesting because voter suppression has been a huge issue in Florida and in other states across the country. And we continue to see that. The governor is trying to enforce that ruling that we passed Amendment 4. Overwhelmingly in the state of Florida, and they brought it to the court.
The amendment that allows felons to vote.
Exactly, restoring felons' rights to vote. And this is another way of making it more and more difficult for people to register to vote. If you have served your time, I know that in many areas in Florida, they're telling former felons who have served their time, who should get their rights restored, to register. But they're scared. They don't want to do anything that's going to go against the law. So I worry more right now, Luis, to tell you the truth, about voter suppression in Florida than I do about election security.
And that case, by the way, going to a federal court. I'm speaking right now with Democratic Representative Debbie McCarcel-Powell. Powell represents District 26, which includes Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. If you have a question for the representative, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial@wlrnnews.org. Congresswoman, amidst the impeachment hearings and the caucuses, you're still getting work done in the House. Let's talk about you're moving forward with this infrastructure plan. There's a $760 billion infrastructure framework that's going to be implemented nationwide. Help us understand, how will that impact us here in South Florida?
For me, it was a priority to be a member of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. And I've been working for months now with the chairman, Peter DeFazio, with the vice chair of the Water Committee, Grace Napolitano, in working on this plan, which we unveiled last week. And it outlines a five-year, $760 billion investment to get our infrastructure working again. If you drive around Miami, if you drive anywhere in South Florida, you understand the need for an infrastructure overhaul. This plan is going to create 10 million new jobs. We're projecting, we don't have the real numbers verified yet, but it's projected to create more than 10 million jobs. And everything that all the investments will also deal with reducing carbon pollution. So we're talking about investments in roads and highways, in public transportation, water infrastructure. In Miami-Dade County, we have 90,000 homes that are still relying on septic tanks that we need to move to sewage. So I'm very excited about this plan. I am hearing that we will be able to get significant bipartisan support here in the House of Representatives. Chairman DeFazio, along with the other chairs of Ways and Means and Financial Services, they will be working closely with the administration also to support this plan. We heard the president in the State of the Union mention infrastructure as one of his commitments to America. So I am optimistic that we can get something done before November, hopefully, since the president made that commitment in the State of the Union.
And one of the facets of the plan is, as you said, it's public transit. And I want to look at rail systems. And really, what kind of investment are you looking at when it comes to rail systems, especially, again, here in South Florida?
We are including $55 billion in investments in rail. This is, again, over 5 years, and we won't know the exact figure for Florida. But, of course, as a member of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and working closely with the chairman, I will be advocating for us to get a significant investment. And as you see, traffic continues to increase. We have a huge problem in South Dade. They wanted rail. They voted for rail. They are still waiting for rail. And so I will be advocating to get significant investments in rail in South Florida.
And is that expanding the rail that we already have, or are we talking about building new infrastructure?
That's a good question. We're not there yet. I actually have had conversations with Brightline and some other companies just to also look into the cost of expanding, whether it's expanding the current system that we have or creating a new line. I know that we used to have a train that would go all the way down to the Keys, and there's still an area in South Dade, but now the county owns it. So it would be interesting to see how we can do a public-private partnership and investing in that transportation system.
You know, one of the issues, obviously, for your district is, you know, in South Florida especially, we look at the issue of sea level rise and climate change. It's going to impact heavily a lot of this area. And parts of Monroe County, I mean, you got parts of the Keys that you know, they are being bought out. We're actually spending money to buy out properties because those houses are we can't protect them anymore. I just want to get a sense from you as we push forward. Is there enough conversation on this issue of climate risk and how it's not just something coming down decades from now? It's an issue right now. And you know, it's something that we have to start spending a lot of money for.
Yes. And you know what, Luis, I have to be honest with you. I don't think overall in this country we're having those conversations that we need to have or bringing attention to this issue. I brought down the chairwoman of the Climate Committee, the Climate Change Committee, Kathy Castor. She's a congresswoman from the central part of Florida. She's a Floridian, and she understands this issue very well, and she's chairing this committee. I brought her down for a tour of the Keys, and during the King Tide season, we saw flooding in the Keys for weeks, and she was able to actually see that. I brought her down a few months ago for her to take a look at that, at those areas. So I'm working closely with FIU and doing research on what we need to do to build more resilient structures along the Keys. The cost of inaction is becoming too high. I know that they're doing research just creating natural seawalls, including some trying to recreate with 3D printing. So I can go on and on about all the things that I've been looking into, but it is going to be very expensive, and we are going to have these conversations with residents along the areas of Monroe County, whether they're going to rebuild after a storm or if they're going to be selling their homes and to a buyback program.
Right. I'm speaking with Democratic Representative Debbie McCarcel Powell, again, representing District 26. You're up for reelection this fall, and we did have your challenger, Republican challenger, Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez, on the program yesterday. Look, he spent almost a decade as mayor, so he's got a lot of name recognition. But what is your message to voters in Miami-Dade County about why you should remain in office? And again, this is going to be a very contentious year, election year.
Luis, when I decided to run, I did it because I had spent 20 years in that community working to improve the quality of life for so many people living in Florida's 26th district. I'm an immigrant. I came here from Ecuador when I was 14. I came with my mother. I saw my mother working two jobs, learning English at nights, on the weekends. I started working at the age of 15. And Because of the opportunities that I have received in this country, I've been able to get to where I am today. And I want to make sure that I provide those same opportunities for thousands and thousands of immigrants that are living in Florida's 26th district. I am a family person. I'm a mom. For me, family is everything. And I see Florida's 26th district as my family. And I have come with the commitment to serve them. I have been working relentlessly on trying to protect our communities from gun violence. I have been working on healthcare issues because I had worked at the FIU Medical School as the associate dean at the medical school, expanding access to care, lowering the cost of premiums and also prescription drugs, and also the environment. I'm passionate about our environment.
But
So
one of the things about this district, it's interesting, it keeps flipping. I mean, so, you know, you had you defeated Republican Carlos Curbelo, who defeated Democrat Joe Garcia. You know, what's the plan? How do you maintain this as a Democratic hold?
My plan is to own this seat for the future, because I know that what my people in Florida's 26th district need is an advocate for them, someone that's going to bring their voices to Washington, D.C. We started our interview with impeachment. That was a very difficult vote for me, because I know that I have Republicans that are living in my district that may not agree with me. I don't come to Washington as a political operative. I come here as a community advocate, and I intend to continue to work for the people of Florida's 26th district. I will be making sure that they know all the things that I'm doing, and I am down every week listening to their voices, and I know what they care about. They care about making sure that their Medicare benefits are not cut. They care about making sure that they can pay for insulin for their children. And yeah, those are the issues that I'm fighting for here in Washington.
She is Democratic Representative Debbie McCarcel Powell. She represents District 26. Congresswoman, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you so much.
Well, still to come, there's a new campaign to encourage young people to avoid vaping products. Can it work? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Food and Drug Administration has launched a nationwide campaign focused on the dangers of e-cigarettes and other tobacco products. In the U.S., it's federally illegal to sell any tobacco product to anyone under 21. That includes cigarettes, cigars, and e-cigarettes. But nationally, nearly 1 in 3 high schoolers are current e-cigarette users, this according to the FDA. Earlier today, we talked to Mitch Zeller. He's the director of the FDA's Center for Tobacco Products, and we talked about the education initiatives that the organization is trying to implement. Mr. Zeller, there are a lot of different types of tobacco products. I mean, you have vaporizers, e-cigarettes, pod or cartridge-based. Tell me a little bit about how each of these are different and the challenges that, you know, in trying to regulate them.
It's an important question, because we have a catch-all for all of them. We call them electronic nicotine delivery systems, because they can appear in so many varieties and types. The form that is by far the most popular with kids in middle school and high school are what we call the cartridge and pod-based products. And the brand, far and away the most popular with kids, is this brand known as Juul. But there are many other branded cartridge and pod-based products. And then when we look at flavors, the flavors that are far and away the most popular with kids are the fruit, the candy, and the mint-flavored cartridge and pod-based products. And so the policy that we announced today, which hopefully will work in conjunction with a new federal minimum age of sale for tobacco products going from 18 to 21, our ongoing compliance and enforcement efforts at FDA, and our public education efforts, all designed to reverse the trend of what's become an epidemic.
You said epidemic, and that, I mean, yeah. I'm wondering, you know, how we've gotten to that point. Yeah, to say that, that's a big term, to use that.
Yeah, we don't throw around terms like epidemic when it comes to any aspect of tobacco use lightly. But here are the numbers. Nationally, we are approaching 1 in 3 high school students that are current e-cigarette users. It's more than 1 in 4, and it's getting closer to 1 in 3. There was a 2-year period in 2016 and 2017 when kids' use of e-cigarettes was either declining or leveling off. We weren't prepared to declare victory at that point, And then the explosion of the popularity of the Juul-like products happened 2018, 2019, and now into 2020. We're doing everything that we can at the federal level with public education and compliance and enforcement, whether it's enforcing the youth access restrictions or going after marketers for putting products out there, purposely putting products out there that resembled juice boxes or breakfast cereals or candy, using social influencers and not making it clear that there's nicotine in the products that these paid social influencers are talking about. We're doing everything that we can using the tools that we have. But when it comes to kids, it is an epidemic. And because a kid who experiments with an e-cigarette is way more likely to then experiment with a cigarette than a kid who doesn't, we put in peril all the progress that has been made nationally.
We've done a lot of studies on, you know, the dangers of tobacco use, but are we sure in the studies that we've done on these new types of products and whatever dangers or risks they may be putting people in?
Questions related to the harm and the risk of e-cigarettes need to be answered in two different ways. First, for adults, and especially adult addicted cigarette smokers, and then second, for kids. So let me take the kids part of it first. Whatever the harms of vaping are, no kid should be experimenting or initiating on e-cigarette. Now, for adults, if you're a pack-a-day smoker and you've been smoking for decades, and for whatever reason, you are unable or unwilling to quit, and you're going to continue to smoke a pack a day for the rest of your life. If we could get all of those people to completely switch from cigarettes to e-cigarettes, regardless of what the harms and the risks of e-cigarettes are, that would probably be a public health benefit. The reality is that most of the adults who use e-cigarettes continue to smoke. They may be smoking fewer cigarettes than they had been before they started vaping, but most adult e-cigarette users continue to smoke. And so the only benefit is going to come from completely transitioning to e-cigarettes. Because e-cigarettes are relatively new, they've only been around for a little over 10 years, I can't tell you what the long-term health risks and consequences of vaping are because they haven't been around long enough for them to be studied. Short term, I can tell you that the risk to kids is great. They risk becoming addicted to the nicotine. There are heavy metals in the aerosol. There are other harmful compounds in the aerosol. Now, relative to cigarettes, it may be less harmful, but for a kid that had never used any of these products, all there is risk and harm, especially when you add to that the possibility that they will go on to smoke regular cigarettes.
Tell me about the Tobacco 21 law.
So in late December, Congress passed and the president signed into law legislation that raises nationally the minimum age of sale for all tobacco products from 18 to 21. That law went into effect immediately in late December. And we at FDA are responsible for enforcing that law nationally. We do that through contracts that we have in every state and territory. But starting on December 20th, retailers had to figure out not to sell any tobacco product to anyone under the age of 21, even if that means just manually checking age and ID. We have provided tools and resources to retailers, including a downloadable app that can be modified to go from 18 to 21 to verify age. But it is the responsibility of retailers not to sell to anyone under the age of 21, and that is the law that we are now responsible for
And
enforcing.
does that include e-cigarettes and these cartridge-based, pod-based products?
It includes e-cigarettes in any form, any flavor, any type, any variety.
I'm speaking with U.S. Food and Drug Administration official Mitch Zeller. He's the director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products. The FDA has launched a nationwide campaign focused on the dangers of e-cigarettes and other vaping products. So what enforcement level do you think is necessary to make sure that retailers are IDing people?
We have to be vigilant, and we have been vigilant from the day the original youth access restrictions went into effect, when the only thing that we were regulating were cigarettes and smokeless tobacco and roll your own tobacco and cigarette rolling papers. And since 2010, again, under these contracts that we have with the states, we have conducted over a million of these unannounced inspections. And the way it works is there is a trained and commissioned adult who accompanies a young person into a gas station, a convenience store, any outlet that would sell any tobacco product, and the young person tries to buy a tobacco product. The good news is that the overwhelming majority of retailers pass. They do not sell to the young people in our program. The bad news is that we've found over 100,000 total violations going back over the last 10 years, and over 10,000 violations just in the last few years when we had regulatory authority over e-cigarettes, and that got included in this enforcement program. And the really unfortunate news is there are a minority of retailers that don't get the message. When you sell illegally the first time, we send that retailer what we call a warning letter. There isn't even a fine. We just put them on notice that they illegally sold to a young person and that we'll be back. They won't know when we'll be back, but starting with a second violation, there are federal fines that kick in and escalating federal fines for repeat violations. And we've had to launch tens of thousands of these civil money penalty actions because of the retailers that repeatedly illegally sold any of the tobacco products, cigarettes, smokeless, and now e-cigarettes to the young people that participate in our enforcement program.
I wanted to move over to this other idea. The city of Miami Beach banned vaping e-cigarettes from public parks. What do you think about that? I mean, do we start pushing on a ban in public spaces?
Well, let me make clear that that's an issue that FDA has no regulatory authority over. But I know that as we look back over so-called smoke-free ordinances and smoke-free laws when it came to cigarettes and cigars, combined with statewide tobacco control efforts, school-based, community-based programs, raising the excise tax on combustible products, and when you throw in the passage and the enforcement of smoke-free laws for cigarettes, those have been proven to work in that comprehensive way to reduce both the consumption and the prevalence of cigarettes. States and localities have the freedom to do what they see is the best step to take when it comes to those kinds of restrictions. I think it's too early to tell what kind of impact they're having on the consumption and prevalence of e-cigarettes, but I can tell you going back 20, 30 years, they were part of the comprehensive approach that has led to historically low smoking rates, both for adults and kids. And Florida has been a leader when it comes to youth prevention and cigarette smoking. Florida has a high school cigarette smoking rate below the national average, and Florida has been a leader for decades in that area.
So the FDA has a youth e-cigarette prevention campaign. It's called The Real Cost, and you've recently launched a video series called My Vaping Mistake, and teens share their stories. How do these kind of campaigns work? And do you think that, you know, that's enough to, you know, really encourage young people to rethink their decisions?
There's no one intervention that is going to reverse this epidemic. It's a comprehensive approach. It's everything that we've talked about. It's the compliance and enforcement, and it's massive public education. In addition to My Vaping Mistake campaign that we've just launched, we're spending tens of millions of dollars on paid advertising, TV, social media, internet, gaming sites. We have an ability to shoot messages to kids on their phones when they're on school grounds and they're going to websites that are popular with kids. It takes this kind of comprehensive effort, but there's no substitute for one teen talking to another about the mistake that they made in thinking that this was a harmless product. And the My Vaping Mistake campaign is very, very powerful, and it will be one piece of the puzzle to reverse this trend.
That was our conversation with U.S. Food and Drug Administration official Mitch Zeller. He's the director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products. You can find more of our reporting on vaping at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, will there soon be parts of the Florida Keys where you can no longer build? Key West Mayor Terry Johnston joins us. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, residents of Key West not too long ago got the chance to see the new FEMA flood maps. And that means they got to see if their flood insurance rates could go up, maybe even go down. Key West, like other islands of the Keys, face some of the greatest threats to sea level rise. We're joined now by Key West Mayor Terry Johnston, joining us from the southernmost bureau of the studios of Key West. Mayor Johnston, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And I just want to mention, if you have a question for the mayor, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can also email us, sundial@WLRNnews.org. I want to get to the maps in a second, but first, because it's happening now in the Florida legislature, and this does go to kind of the way Tallahassee looks at the keys, but recently there was an amendment that was added to House Bill 587, which would bump up hurricane evacuation time from 24 to 30 hours. A lot of people got angry because they said, oh, now there could be a development boom in the Keys because of this. Why?
Well, I think when you have an additional 6 hours on a hurricane evacuation time, that allows more building because it is it's based on occupancy. So we right now are at the cutting edge of 24 hours with our exact same population. So bumping it up to 30 hours, adding 6 hours to it, is going to offer us the opportunity to build, which I will tell you right now is meeting with much opposition from every one of the communities and certainly Key West. We're at the tip of the chain. We're the first people to get on US 1, a two-lane highway, to evacuate, and we see adding six additional hours and more people as a very dangerous move for the Keys.
After Irma, what was the biggest lesson learned about evacuation and especially the ability for people to get back to their homes after?
Well, we did have a situation after Irma because it took 10 days to get back into the Keys. And I think some of the lessons that we learned were certainly communication. I think we all are striving to have a better communication network during the next weather issue. So that's one of them. And also the other issue that we continue to battle is that people simply will not leave. People won't leave their homes. We anticipate that they will, so we're not prepared with first responders to take care of them. We're not prepared for water, food, medical emergencies. We're just taking care of getting the Keys back up and running so everybody can come back. So that's an ongoing issue for us in Key West and all up and down the Keys.
You know, we come back to this idea of, you know, more development in the Keys. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my understanding is that haven't we, or we are about to reach a point of, well, no more development because there's no more room. We've reached build out.
Yeah. Well, we certainly are in Key West. We have had 100 vacant lots for about the last 6 or 7 years, and we have covered those 7 years ago with our building allocation system, which is called BPAS, our building allocation. And so we have those covered, but basically there is no new land. Everything that we do in Key West is a redevelopment. We tear something down and we rebuild it. So we are all already at close to build out in Key West.
And my understanding is for Monroe County, not just Key West, but the county, build out is coming up in like 2023.
Yes, it is. And at that time, you know, we will certainly have that very difficult decision at the state level whether any additional building allocations are added. And I believe that there's a consensus that, you know, we're pretty much at capacity. You know, we used to have a slow season in Key West, which was, you know, in the summer months. We no longer have that because of the drive down traffic from Miami-Dade County. So we are busy 12 months out of the year in Key West. And I believe if you talk to any local, they would say we've got plenty of people here.
And you have that happening at the same time the state is spending federal dollars to demolish some of the properties that were damaged from Irma and turning that land back into its natural state to hopefully use it as a barrier from future storms. But, I mean, as storms intensify and we deal with more flooding issues, what do you think will be some of the bigger challenges, especially for Key West?
Well, I think after the remapping, you know, a considerable amount of Key West is below base flood elevation. We have been very active for years. We've had the strongest building codes in the state, and we've had them since the 80s. One of the really positive things, if you can look at one positive thing that happened from Irma, is that many of the homes that were built to lower building codes and were substandard were demolished. I mean, they were wiped out by Irma, and they were rebuilt based on 180 mile an hour wind codes and impact windows and and roof ties and things of that nature, which actually harden the home. And so if there's any positive that came from Irma, it's that we lost some of the very vulnerable homes and we gained some homes that have been raised and certainly are hardened for future wind and water events.
How confident are you in those building codes considering this? Dorian showed us that, you know, you had very strong building codes in the Bahamas because they're used to what they know. But Dorian was a unique storm. It was powerful, and then it slowed down to almost a stop, which made it more destructive. If something like that happened, how confident are you Key West is ready?
Well, I think anytime you look at a storm that sets over top of you and is just able to hammer you for hour upon hour upon hour is going to stretch any building code. But I can show you photos from Irma where a storm came through perhaps a Big Pine area, and there was one house that's standing out of four, and that house has been built within the last 5 years and is built to the stronger building codes. So, you know, certainly I think it's a guess what would happen if a storm set over the top of Key West, you know, for 12, 16, 20 hours. It certainly would stretch any building code we have. But I'm very confident that the building codes that we have in place, certainly for the storm patterns that we've had and the weather events that we've weathered, stand up very well. We also have one of the things that stands up well, is some of our older homes in the historic Key West that were built by shipmakers because they're wood structures. Many of them are peg and post, and they have this incredible ability in a strong wind to rock. They sway instead of break. So we've got some really positive things going here in Key West also.
We're talking with Key West Mayor Terry Johnston. Again, if you have a question, you can share it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. I wanted to come back to the FEMA flood maps. And, mm-hmm. and again, this is a part of the process. These are preliminary maps people could see. And, well, people could see that things have changed. And some people find themselves now in situations they didn't know they had. So that means some people's flood insurance is going to go up and others may go down. But what have you heard from residents about what they've seen so far?
Well, first of all, what I've heard is that we have been running workshops all throughout the Keys to bring people in to sit down and talk to FEMA, to talk to their insurance company so they understand exactly where their property sits. And what that does is it gives them options. Do you want to raise your home? Can you harden your home? And prepare for if they do have an insurance hike. What it did alert a number of people, particularly in Key West, was the fact that you needed to have flood insurance. Whether you have a mortgage or not, you need to have flood insurance because you're grandfathered in. So that's been one positive aspect. But I think what it does is it gives people a clear understanding of where their rates are going to be and allow them to make some decisions about their future. But we also had 600 homes in Key West that actually were raised as far as the floodplain that they were previously listed at. So those homes actually improved.
How did it impact you?
We lost 2 feet. We lost 2 feet in our current location, which is a pretty common number throughout Key West.
So in certain parts of the island look better off than they did than other parts, really.
Yes, and it was interesting the areas that did, which you would think it would be the middle of the island, which was not necessarily true. It was pretty much the outer edges of the island. And the FEMA maps included a new technique in order to calculate base flood elevation. So it was a better, more accurate technique, and I think that's the reason that we had some changes both up and down. And
did you hear any concern from people? Because, this is something that's going to affect everybody in South Florida at some point when new maps come out, is that some people may find it's just going to be a lot more expensive to live here than it's already pricey, but it's going to be even more expensive if you've got to cover it.
It is. There's a number of people who are going to see an increase in their insurance rates. And, that's part of living in Monroe County. You know, we have had some of the highest windstorm insurance rates without much justification, I will say, for years and years and years. But now our flood rates are going to start to go up. So that's a decision that every single homeowner has to make as far as the their goal and their desire to stay in the Florida Keys or move somewhere else where it's less expensive. But the people that I saw at our flood insurance programs, they welcomed the information because it allowed them to make personal decisions. And there are a number of things that we can do. Right now you could drive through Key West and you will see probably 10 houses being raised, particularly the wood-framed houses. We have a number of companies in Miami-Dade that will come down and raise your house. We've legislated new rules and regulations allowing people to raise their house many times 4 feet above their base flood elevation. So we are preparing, and we're giving everyone as much help and as many options as possible in order to work with the effects of climate change that everyone is going to experience.
Right now, I want to come back to Tallahassee because Key West, not too long ago, passed an ordinance on the use of certain sunscreens. Yes. That they couldn't be sold because the chemicals in these sunscreens were damaging to corals. And then, of course, we've seen communities up and down South Florida passing ordinances on plastics and different things. The state is pushing back. The state is pushing back. Tallahassee is pushing back on this idea that, you know what, cities can't pass these rules. These have to be by the state. What do you think about that?
Not much. Not much.
Okay.
And I will tell you, the reason for that is that there isn't any legislator in the state of Florida that knows more about Key West and the impacts to our, you know, one of the three remaining coral reefs than the citizens of Key West and the legislators in Key West. We make our living on the water and with a strong emphasis on the reef. So for somebody in North Florida to say, you know, I feel that we need to walk that ban back, is I feel a really, really poorly thought out legislation. I would much rather have our legislators right now working to get our FEMA money released that's been held in hostage at the state level for about 18 months
You're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of FEMA money that we talked about it on the show not too long ago. But just real quickly, if the state decides no, home rule can't fit, you know, it can't work, and it has to be a state decision because we want uniform rules across the state, and then all of a sudden you can't put bans on these kind of things, then what do you do?
Well, first of all, we don't have a uniform state. We couldn't be more diabolically different than Northern Florida. I mean, we couldn't. It's just day and night. So if you're going to legislate effectively, legislate on issues that truly do impact an area, both positively and negatively. And my issue with this ban is, A, not one single person came down to Key West to see what the value and what the impact is on our coral reef. If you just talk to NOAA, you would understand the degradation of our coral reef in the past 20 years. And if you took a look at our economy, you would understand how vitally and important it is for jobs and for the economy of Key West and the Lower Keys. So when you say, you know, one size fits all, it just does not. And we elected these folks to represent us. Well, if you're going to represent us, you have to understand us. So please come down and see exactly what you're legislating.
For the most part, everybody in Key West most people in Key West are pretty happy with the decision.
Sunscreen. Yes, absolutely. You know, you can't do it all, and we understand that our reef is under attack by a number of different issues. But if you can do something, why on earth would you not do that? So that's our motto. If we can do something, we're going to do everything that we can in order to protect our coral reef. The same thing with our plastics, single-use plastics. Yeah. We find them all over our nearshore waters. You know, they're just a disaster with our marine life. So why wouldn't you allow a community to ban those?
We've been talking with Key West Mayor Terry Johnston, joining us from the studios of Key West. Mayor, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And again, if you have any questions or thoughts, you can always find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that is the program for this Thursday, February 6th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Our engagement editor is Katie Leprey. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Well, in case if you missed it, for the month of February, we've been reading Craig Pittman's new book, Cattail. As a longtime environment reporter for the Tampa Bay Times, Craig has followed some of the fascinating characters responsible for saving the Florida panther from extinction. Now, we have an event this Saturday night with Craig at the Books and Books in Coral Gables. We're going to be discussing his book and some of the unbelievable stories that he's reported on, including Skunk Ape. So just a little tease. So you can reserve your tickets for the event. Find more information. Go to Facebook and search Sundial Book Club. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday. Hope to see you on Saturday's event. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again next Monday.